I woke up in my bed, and then my room, my bedroom, was designed by Google or by McDonald's or Coca-Cola, or some whoever,
They could change it every
or by
day.
you guys, with your own agenda for how my life would run. And I go out in the kitchen, and then something else happened, and the music comes on, and it's all sort of low tech, but it's all designed by someone else, like with a purpose. Then that would be a problem, and this is what we have more and more online.
Jordan Peterson has called for a need to rediscover the spirit of the Father. Many have been inspired to embark on their own hero's journey to set their life in order. But how do we balance order and chaos to live a life of meaning? What does it actually mean to be surrendered to God? And how do we root ourselves to stable ground as we witness the re-enchantment of reality? At Manifesto, we're engaged on a mission to rediscover and understand manhood, and from this foundation to create a dynamic and thriving community. My name's Paul. Welcome to Manifesto.
Kayla Coyle, welcome to Manifesto's YouTube channel and podcast. Good to have you on here.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you are one of the, I mean, could one say you're one of the giants of men's work in Scandinavia? At least you're the board president of the largest men's work organization in the Nordics and in the world, the Mankind Project. And you're also sitting, I think, in your office now at the University of Umeå in Sweden, right?
That's right, yes. So I'm the chairman for the Nordic branch of the Mankind Project, which is a huge international organization and growing in Sweden and in the Nordics.
Yeah. Yeah, and you were on my new warrior training that I attended in Sweden back in 2017, we recalled. And maybe can you tell us just a little bit about how, and there's also something called man and mission, and that's what we're going to talk a little bit about today. But can you tell us, how did you get into this thing called men's work and get involved in Mankind Project? Where did that all come from?
Sure, happy to tell that story. The first men's group I happened to be in was much of a coincidence. I was into sharing circles and sitting down, talking about important things. And the group that I found in the little village I lived happened to be a men's group. Later on in the UK, I wanted the same thing. And I found out there was a local men's group, but I had to do this thing called the New Warrior Training Adventure to be able to be in the men's group. So I sort of came from men's groups to the New Warrior Training. But when I looked that up online to make my decision, because this was a weekend, it had a price, it was a big step in a way. What I saw about mission was actually what attracted me to do this. There are a lot of aspects to this training and a lot of testimonies, but the thing about mission sort of struck something in me, because I was considering some options professionally. I had a young child, a second one coming. And I had this decision whether I should go for a more secure employment, or maybe go more for an international, more exciting research career. And these kinds of things were in my head. And I was abroad and didn't have much of a network. It felt very open, my future at that point. So that's how I sort of got into Mankind Project. And then a few years later, I was one of the people who brought that to Sweden and the Nordic. And we started in 2015 was the organization was founded. And we had the first New Warrior Training in 16. But actually before that, I started the Man in Mission annual course. I think 2013 was the first one with Peter Ellenberg at Mundekulla Course and Retreat Center.
Yeah. Okay, maybe I can just go back quickly. So that very first group you were in, where you said you were... Now we just got highlighted. Thanks, Loris. The very first group you were in, you said you're living in a small town, and that was just the group that happened to be there. And what was it? There was obviously something there that you appreciated that made you think like, oh, there's something good about just being a group of guys.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yes. What was that?
So I had a lot of experience sitting down in groups, talking about my feelings, about important things, being heard and listened to, which is unusual, I think. Yeah. So that's something that I also treasure and that I carry forward and lead myself to this day. But then when I was in this group of men, I felt another kind of challenge in a way, and also a connection with these guys. And I realized that we had so much similar experiences. so something I had like some hesitation towards before. I called myself a feminist, and I thought that the best thing we can do is to try to avoid focusing so much on our differences. You know, people are people, people are different. It doesn't really matter what gender you are. That's where I was coming from. And then I experienced this interesting sort of connection with these men and the similarities and the challenges we faced. And we had topics on these meetings like money, competition, sex. And these are excellent topics to talk to with other men and compare experiences, and also sort of feel that the tension and the love in the room around these topics. It's quite different from speaking about the same things with a mixed group.
Yeah. Okay. So you were actually a feminist at that time. Do you still consider yourself to be a feminist, or is that something you've moderated since then? I know, in being a university professor in Sweden, it helps to be a feminist, I assume, right? It's not a bad thing for the CV.
It can mean so many different things. And what I meant then, and what I, in the sense that I'm still a feminist, if I am, is that I recognize that there are these patterns of gender roles and oppression that do harm both men and women. Mm-hmm. But because I recognize that there are historical oppressive structures in society that has hurt women, mm-hmm. I'm a feminist in that sense. But then I can also, I guess, be a manist, or like a masculinist, because I see that these other structures have hurt men and are hurting men. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, yes.
Okay. Yeah. I would tend to stay away from both aspects, but I certainly resonate with I've met so many guys as well who have this experience of just being able to like this kind of relaxation that can happen from being a group of guys. But I live in a small town here as well, and there's also a little bit of resistance to the idea of men just being together, but it's normally by men who've never tried it. And when they try it, then and who haven't tried it in a relaxed setting or an intentional setting, maybe as well, where there's some male fellowships, I guess, are centered around, you know, like alcohol or aggression against other people or something like that. And then, of course, this, I think that's where some of this comes from, whereas, or just like a kind of a dominance hierarchy structure of kind of, you know, being more alpha. And maybe, I guess, most boys' schools have that, right? Where like in school time, a lot of boys are just like, you know, childishly competing with each other. And so there seems to be real value in just re-experiencing male fellowship.
Absolutely. And now I know that from the inside. And I've had the same experience. At one point, I invited a friend of a friend, and he declined to be in this men's group with me because he said that the only condition on which I will ever be in an exclusive men's group is if we talk about inequality and how it hurts women and what we can do about that. That was the only topic he was interested in talking about, and not, for example, supporting each other and, you know, finding common ground and developing ourselves, empowering ourselves, which was what I was wanting to do with him.
And that's a pity, and I get it why people are like that, because the culture is so full of, like, you know, basically, you know, the focusing on the negativity of the male psyche, I guess. But it's just such not a productive way of being together, right? There's I've never been in a men's group like that, but I could just imagine how I kind of get sick in the stomach at the thought of it. Just like guys kind of wallowing in their own shame of how bad they are. It doesn't sound very healthy, actually, right? Sounds quite destructive, like a very negative thing to get around. It's like how bad and evil we all are, and how much, you know. So I get it, and I think it's great. And I also think that, you know, from the beginning manifesto, we've had people who are men's rights activists, and we've had people who call themselves feminists. And I think it's really good to have the conversation between those two things, because, you know, there are insights from a wide variety, and especially in the meeting between them, right? To not be that echo chamber where we kind of exclude the one side or the other. But I think you said something really interesting as well, which is this idea about mission. And we talk a lot about purpose in manifesto. And we talk a lot about, like, how does one find a sense of purpose in a postmodern world where everything is flat and being deconstructed, and there are no role models or passions to follow from our grandparents and stuff like that as well. So maybe you've been working with this now since, you said, 2013, so getting on to 10 years with Man on Mission. What's your take and experience on finding mission in today's society for men?
Great question. I think I might have two kinds of answers. We'll see. I'll start with the first one. Finding one's mission. I mean, one thing is it's so much easier if you first are doing relatively well, right? So if you're not, if you haven't, don't have a connection to your emotions, if you feel all this competition with other men, for example, there are things that you want might want to start with. And that's what we do during the short Union Man in Mission weekend. We don't start with mission work. We start with connecting, making sure everybody feels safe, you know, sharing something about themselves, being sort of held and seen and all that. So that, and often we lack this in real life. So I think it can be a way out of misery or difficulty to think about something outside yourself and start striving for that. Start working towards helping your neighbor or helping the environment or doing something outside of yourself. I think that's good for anyone, but it's difficult. So the way I see sort of personal development, it's better to start with sort of healing, supporting people and holding them. And then once that you got, you know, some way onto that path and that healing, then it's so much easier to open up to, okay, so what do I now want to contribute with? So there's this sort of lack, scarcity of attention in our society, scarcity of love, scarcity of touch. And we need to, should, when we can give that to each other, to enable ourselves to grow and become stronger and find more purpose. So that's one indirect answer. How do I find purpose? Well, I you know, I care for myself and others and sort of open up the space for it. But another kind of answer that I like and that I gotten from MKP partly and from the book King, Warrior, Magician, Lover by Robert Moore is another inspiration, which has inspired the Mankind Project and also inspired the Man in Mission, is to go into the king energy, as Moore says, the sort of sovereign energy, which means to look at myself and my life and my opportunities from a sense of overview and sort of honoring and seeing the good. So when I see what's good in my life or in the world, when I can start to appreciate things and even maybe love things, love people, I love my children, I love the way they develop, I love to see their personalities come out, and building on the appreciation and love and seeing the good, then that's the way to find my mission and purpose, because then of course I want to give to those positive powers and developments. So once I get into that sort of sovereign energy, then I can stake out my direction. So the similarity with both these answers is, I don't think, like in any state of mind, you can just ask someone to like define your purpose, do it now. You know, you have 10 seconds. You could do that as an exercise, I suppose, and something will come out and might be useful. But to find something more lasting that can direct and organize your life, I think you do need both of these things. You need to be take care of yourself, and then you need to find that sort of sovereign spot and see the good. And that will sort of provide you the answer. And then, yeah, try out different things. I've never been one for sort of controlling myself very much and sticking to routines or habits. I know a lot of people do that and can be quite rewarding. It hasn't been my path. I did a bit of yoga earlier and tried an ascetic path, and it felt it wasn't for me to keep up this, you know, sort of strenuous practices. So since then, I've been more sort of lust oriented, or, you know, passion oriented. So that's at least for me, finding the love and building on that and finding my purpose based on what resonates with me in that sort of part of me is how I find purpose.
Okay. Well, I'll mention first, I think it's great that you kind of have these two movements, outwards and inwards. And I guess that's an iterative process that gets repeated. And, you know, there's constantly areas where, you know, I'm not seeing things clearly outside of myself because there's something inside of myself that isn't aligned properly, right? So I think that back and forth motion, I think some self-development programs and spiritual communities can get very stuck on the kind of inwards looking, you know, constantly going back and never actually making the movement outwards. But I think, you know, being in a community where we're constantly engaged in doing stuff, but also constantly listening to criticism, feedback, and, you know, working through things and thinking, how can we make things better, is a good process. I want to dig a little bit into what you said about being driven by, you said lust and passion. Because, I mean, you're a university professor who sits and writes these scholarly articles, which are kind of, I mean, some people might use the word dry or something like that, I guess, right? You're into philosophy. And I imagine that that's also not a life where you're like kind of, you know, going out on these like crazy escapades across Sweden, doing all kinds of weird, wonderful things. You're father of kids as well.
Yeah, I do that in my head.
Yeah.
You know? If I allow my mind to wander this strange paths, and it does make a huge difference in my work, which is in that sense dry from the outside. It's intellectual, it's at the desk, and it's a huge difference whether I try to do what I calculate is the most useful, or I try to follow, like identify some norms and follow them, and or you know, maximize my CV, you know, what would look best, or if I go for what am I passionate about? What ideas am I passionate about pursuing and trying and allowing myself to stay with that? So this is a struggle for me. I'm not saying I do this all the time, but that's what I try to do. And I think I do it more and more over time. It's also easier once you're more established. I mean, I have my permanent employment and so forth.
Yeah, because I struggle with these words as well. Sometimes I say to guys in core and manifesto, like I strongly believe in following your desire. Because I believe that desire ultimately is a desire towards the best, towards God or towards the transcendent or whatever it is you want to call it, right? But then I always, recently I've been kind of thinking like, well, is this a mistake to use this kind of language? Because even, you know, I can say for myself as well, but I actually think as well, like, you know, I mean, let's be honest, you know, like for most men, desire is like getting laid by as many women as possible, as quickly as possible, and like living out as many of their pornographic fantasies that they could possibly, you know, squeeze into the next 24 hours or something like that. And like, you know, some crazy, wild, hedonistic expression, right? And so I don't know, how do you manage that?
Yeah, again, great question. Yes, that's true. And that's an important distinction.
Probably so, doing that won't be the most productive thing for you to live out your mission, right? If you actually went out and tried to live out all of your
fantasies. That's true.
Or what?
Yeah, so this goes back to what I need in order to prepare myself to be able to live a life of purpose. So if my strong immediate desire is to have sex with as many women as possible or in many ways, then I need to sort of get that desire taken care of somehow. And in my case, it wouldn't be repressing it or you know, saying I shouldn't have it. It would be to go to some kind of tantric event or, you know, some place where that kind of desire can be lived out in a good sort of healthy way.
What happens if you're a pedophile and you want to have sex with small children?
Yeah. Not every desire can be.
Or have rape fantasies.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, I mean, yeah.
That's true. Yeah, there are limits. I think most things there are. Yeah, I have no experience of that myself. I'm not saying anything can be done. I think almost all desires that almost all of us have some kind of healthy outlet. You can play rape games, you know, role play rape scenarios with your lover if you have one, or like, you know, BDSM workshops. But I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are people who really want, you know, some particular thing that you can't have consensually with anyone, and yeah, that's too bad. People are so varied, so I wouldn't say that's not possible.
Yeah, but... and I also want to question, I'm going to be a little bit more opinionated now myself as well. I want to question this idea of like, oh, just because it's consensual then like everything is okay, because I've just been in so many, you know, I've seen many of these communities where people engage in sexual exploration with each other, playing out their traumas, and so most of these communities are very much characterized by a lot of chaos and a lot of drama and a lot of breakdown of, you know, good solid relationships. So, you know, the number of couples, I know of two couples who've been involved in Tantra for a long time and managed to stay together and have a stable relationship, even with kids. And that both of them will say like, well, they're able to do this because they were married for a long time beforehand. And that's what kind of gives them the ballast to be able to go into this. But I kind of feel like in a culture today, we've become this thing like, oh, we can never criticize anybody else's sexuality and everything is perfectly okay. And it's very, very bad and evil. If you ever have any kind of judgment about someone else's sexuality, then you're kind of like being evil somehow. And at the same time, I think our culture doesn't have any kind of guards against this. And I myself also explore a lot of this stuff and when I look back on it, I just see like a trail of chaos and drama and destruction and people's lives, you know, really just going to the gutter, and some people never getting out of it as well. Like really never getting out of it, you know, like 10, 15 years later, just still not even able to go into social situations, right? Because of like major, major breakdowns. And often these things are combined with psychedelic drugs and, you know, heavy use of marijuana as well and things like that. And rant finished. I'll stop there.
That's fine. Yeah, this is interesting. So going back to your question was, I said to find purpose, it's best to first take care of yourself and attend to your desires. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's not about repressing them and shutting them down. It's about giving them an outlet in some sense.
Yeah.
And you said, what if it's sex? And I said, yeah, then you have Tantra. You might have said something else. What if it's being like, you know, aggressive? Then, yeah, martial arts maybe, shooting. I don't know. I mean, there are outlets for different things and not all of them are good. Then you said, yeah, okay, so Tantra, but that can be problematic. Sure, it can. My experiences are quite positive. I've never dived into it. It hasn't been part of my everyday at any point. So maybe, and hasn't been on drugs. But, so I think my maybe difference from different people, but I think certainly sexuality can be attended to, like in a group setting, in a very positive and healthy way. Mm-hmm. I think that's quite possible. It's also possible to do it in a bad way, which is true for anything. Mm-hmm. Adding to that, though, in the listening context that I started out with, like my personal development path started with something called the Circle Way, which is about deep listening when I was 20. And I now lead these camps also with my wife. And I have experienced and I've seen people in these contexts, having very little physical connection, they're hugging perhaps, holding hands, sitting close, listening, and how that has really changed my perception of women and connection and sexuality. And I've felt liberated at these camps when I was younger, seeing naked women, you know, in a sweat lodge or in like ceremonial contexts, and not feeling the sexual desire kicking in, because I'd just been so close to them and it was so natural and we were all like a family. And I think that happened for many reasons, but because of the communal sense and the connection with them as persons. And I don't think it's not the case that, oh, now I see you as a person, so you're not a sexual person for me. It can be both, obviously. It's about feeling connected and held and feeling the love, and that fulfills me, right? So I think part of my sex drive, there's a natural sex drive, obviously, but part of my sort of modern sex drive, my desire, this desire in my head that you talked about, you living out the fantasies, is about connection and you know, a lot of things. So touch and attention. And
I absolutely agree. I think that a lot of these, you know, like the fantasies, for me, it's like it comes from like feeding the fantasies and the sexual obsession, then it just goes further and further and further. Like our brain is that way, that we need like more extreme things to get the same kick. And so I think sexual addiction is the core issue here. But what people are really looking for is just human connection, intimacy, being met, you know, connection with another living being, that yearning. And so then, it gets played out in these different ways, and then it goes into violence as well. So like then, you know, like physically inflicting pain, sometimes starting as a play thing, or it's like, you know, rape play or something like that, but then often going to real physical pain. And you know, and then one of the leading causes in suicide, and I think it's Finland, is like, you know, people who actually kill themselves through different kinds of like asphyxiation, sexual play as well, right? Like it's a very common cause of death. Which, you know, so like this is serious stuff. It's not a very nice way to go. It's like choke yourself or your partner to death, trying to get like another higher kick out of a sexual peak experience, right? Like it's not a very nice way to die, but like
I just had a thought, a new thought for me, that maybe like if my purpose is to find purpose, and I sound like I can't really find the purpose now, it's so clouded and I have all these desires, I feel, you know, I have these needs. And maybe the purpose to find purpose can be something that keeps you on track when you decide to, okay, I realize I have the desires, I have these needs, I need to do something about them. So how can I do that? What kind of tantra event should I go to, or should it be more like a, you know, a listening event or something else? It'd be close to my neighbors or my family. Then if the whole purpose of that is something further, it's not about fulfilling your desires, right? It's about becoming a better person in some sense, or you know, yeah, being a man with a purpose as opposed to just me and myself being the purpose. Then that can maybe guide us in finding what venues will be helpful and fruitful for that.
Well, I mean, it's difficult questions to answer, and what I found is, like, you know, I have lots of opinions, as you can hear, but like I can't expect anybody to, you know, they can be inspired by what by my stories, I guess, but everybody needs to go out and find these things for themselves, because just the idea of like a better man, like, you know, what does that really mean? And I had a shift probably when I was around 32, where I kind of realized, like, oh, my entire life has been orientated around me. And so there was a drastic difference. So even when I was doing things for other people, you know, I realized like it was really something I was doing to feed my own self-image or the way people perceive me or something like that. But it was always me in the center. And so, you know, it was a kind of like a very drastic shift of perspective to see suddenly, like, well, you know, like it's so much, life is so much more interesting when it's not about me. But
Yeah,
like,
that's like a mental illness of our time, maybe of all times, but maybe
yeah,
in some new
narcissism, right?
fashion.
And I think it's connected to our abundance and the comfort of our society, which disconnects us from reality. And it's the screens that we look at every single day that are feeding us this individual. Basically, they're making you into a consumer. Like the algorithms are designed. I mean, yeah. So this now we're maybe straying into your work as a philosopher at the university a little bit, but like, aren't we going through a major shift in what human consciousness is, and that it's now mediated through, you know, AI algorithms that are an extension of our being and are actually determining what reality is for all of us?
Yeah, yes, for sure. For sure. The online environment, it's more and more our living environment, and it has, yeah, it's a new experience, a new research field. So, but one thing we know for sure, of course, is that this environment is designed very much by for-profit businesses that do it for their own purposes. So these algorithms aren't even designed to try to improve us or help us, but to catch our attention and keep our attention and sell advertising. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite a scary thing to think about. And one of the things that I'm aware of is that, like, well, hey, we're most of these algorithms are designed by guys. A lot of them are quite nerdy and academic, probably also often lonely.
Yeah,
And
maybe, yeah.
also, and then I would also say, like, you know, so that they want to be good guys, but like they're often susceptible to other things. You know, some of them probably have, like, you know, all kinds of the problems that we've been talking about right now themselves. But like we're kind of in a unique position sometimes in the field of men's work to be addressing this. And I don't really know what the level is, but what I found is, like, I don't think it's through politics. I don't think the political system's going to solve it. I think it goes through, like, you know, the hearts and minds of individual humans who are working in this field, preferably.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I don't have any solutions. I have written about this actually. I have a book chapter on this online environment, and there I guess I take a regulative perspective, political perspective. Most of what I do is political philosophy in some sense, and I just note that how it's not just the case that the environment is designed by sort of this for-profit businesses or by other people, other forces. It's also that we're defaulted into so many things, so. We can do pretty much everything on the internet or on Facebook, find any kind of information, but we present it automatically, of course, with the content. And there's something particularly, I think, sort of intrusive or the power relationship when you can default people into something that's more difficult in the natural environment. You can have a pathway that people are supposed to walk on, but they can also walk on the grass unless you have really high fences, right? But online, it's so difficult unless you're a, you know, proficient hacker. You can't go outside of those paths. So it's just you're automated into this all the situations. And I think then society should ideally, you know, have higher requirements, higher quality requirements. If you're going to offer people a product on the market, it has to have, live up to some sort of basic levels of safety and usability. Mm-hmm. But if you want to default people into something so that they sort of automatically get it unless they opt out, then there should be like a higher quality bar for that. But that's me thinking as a, like, how should society ideally be designed? Well, we should have different, you know, requirements for these different kinds of products. But how to,
but
how
you're,
to get
you're
there.
Kind of assuming that we still have control, or that we can get control. And I would say, like, we've actually already lost control. Like, that, you know, like, we're not in control anymore. We, the singularity has happened. Like, it's taken over. We're already rewiring our, you know, I see kids down like 9 months old, 1 year old, sitting just with a phone for hours with YouTube. And what are these kids like to interact with after they've been sitting and looking at YouTube on a phone for a couple of hours, right? Like, they're just totally in another space. Like, they're not themselves anymore. But YouTube has a very, very well-designed algorithm to grab the attention of a two-year-old. It's an expert at it. It will hold that kid far more entertained than any adult would ever be able to do. And so it's a finely, finely tuned algorithm that knows exactly how to grab and hold its attention. And that's just means that it's created like a neural pathway into that child. And as that child grows older, it's not going to be able to get over that addiction. You know, it's just going to be stronger. Am I right?
Yeah. No, I agree. Can we do anything about it? I mean, we can, as a society, we can. You and I, maybe not. We can try. The Swedish government, maybe not so much. The US government, more so. Mm-hmm. Things have happened. The Russian Revolution happened. Not saying it was good, but it sort of happened against all odds.
I think the Russian Revolution was good.
No, I'm not saying it was good. I'm saying it was unexpected. You know?
Okay.
You have the Tsar dictatorship, and you have some, you know, random revolutionaries gathering, you know, in the early days of Lenin. And when he was in Sweden visiting, for example, who might have thought that he was going to overthrow the Russian government? Just an example of how history can surprise us. So I wouldn't say we can't do anything about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, looking at what social movements and revolutionaries, for example, have accomplished in the past, I would never say that, you know, in 10 years we have no chance.
I mean, I would say normally they make it worse. I think Russia is a good example of how revolutions, like, we think like, oh, we're going to make it all better if we just revolt, and then like it gets worse, right? It's like, oh, now it's all be better when we take over because we took it over by force. Or
Maybe that's a bad example. Maybe I should emphasize that I'm not for revolutions. I'm just thinking, it sounded like you said, some sort of fatalistic, like we can't do anything about this. The company's just going to run it their way and just sort of give up. But I was saying that, I think things might happen.
I'm really interested in a guy, and I'm going to ask open for questions from the rest of the guys after this. So guys, we'll take one or two questions if anybody. Otherwise I'll tell Alex to ask the question if no one else does, or Floris. I follow a guy called Jonathan Peugeot. He runs a YouTube channel called The Symbolic World. He also came and was the main speaker at our event last year, the European Men's Gathering. And so he's an Orthodox icon carver and an artist who kind of interprets current events through a Orthodox mythological kind of storytelling lens somehow. And he compares the internet, large companies like Google, Facebook, also just AI, with what he calls principalities and powers, like spiritual beings. Hmm. You can kind of see the way there. If you can also see like a forest as a kind of a being or a body that has an intelligence to it as well. And so if you look at that as a being or a principality, then, or, you know, the same as like a city, you can write to a city and the city will answer you. It won't be, you know, Jane, the bureaucrat sitting there answering. It's actually the city that replies. And so he kind of sees this through a kind of biblical approach to understanding principalities or angels and demons even as well, right? And how this aligns up with ancient literature on that subject as well. So is that something you're aware of at all, that approach of looking at things? Jordan Peterson also kind of brought a lot of it in with his kind of, you know, looking at the psychological reference in you know, mythology and biblical literature analyze and understand our society today. And these guys are all talking about like what they called re-enchantment, like, you know, like enchantment is coming back into the world somehow.
Hmm. No, Not at all.
No. Actually, that I didn't mean, make it to Umeå University yet.
No, I mean, I'm not sure if it's interesting, but there's certainly a movement in modern analytical philosophy, I guess I should call what I'm doing maybe, sort of the mainstream kind of philosophy in Sweden and the UK, etc., which is the social sort of ontology, as we call it, of groups. So what are groups or these kind of entities, corporations? Do they have agency? Do they have responsibility? Does it make sense to sort of call them out morally and require things from them? Are they moral agents? Are they even moral sort of patients? Should we care about them independently? So these kinds of issues are much discussed, but the connection to mythology, etc., seems more maybe would be with my colleagues down the hall who are doing religious studies, maybe.
Okay. If they're not, I mean, the normal approach in religious studies is like deconstruct everything and pull it down to the lowest possible level, where what I heard you're saying is like, you know, we have this tendency to just focus on the individual level of the single human being. And if you're starting to like build things up again or see like, okay, there's multiple levels of analysis that are actually highly conducive to or useful for considering is a good way of looking at things. And certainly that's what I'm seeing in the work in Manifesto as well. Sometimes we check in as in our team leader meeting, we check in as our team, as if our team was a person. And that you can kind of give a very apt description of the team through representing as a person, actually, with different body parts and all that kind of stuff as well.
So, yeah, I mean, I love that. That's what we do in the Circle Way camps, for example, is to create a strong sense of community. Yeah. And being and having the experience after a few days that it makes sense to say that, yes, I'm in this clan, and the clan is part of a tribe, because this is influenced by Native American then sort of mythology, actually, to some extent, but at least how we sort of organize it. That is, I think, great, and it's a good counter force to a lot of the individualistic experiences we are fed.
Just a family as a single body as well that needs to function with different roles and different parts as well in any community.
Yeah, for sure.
Good. Guys, who has a question for us for Kalle to anything that's been interesting from here? Let's hear it, Floris.
My question is actually coming back to the algorithm that you talked about, Paul, about children or babies even already with their phones attached. And I was actually curious because, well, for babies, looking at something or even looking at something else, it's just like, I would say, input, output. I mean, so I'm a little bit skeptic that if a baby watches already a phone, then he will be addicted for the rest of his life. And also that when I see these pictures, and I will get to my question, but when I see these pictures where you see some shout out about how people nowadays in the train or in the bus always looking at their screens, their phones. But then in retrospect, if you compare it to a photo taken, I would say, 70 or 80 years ago, everybody would read their newspaper. So I would say, what has changed in that matter? But the thing is that wouldn't humanity in that sense, or an addicted baby, for example, with his phone, at some point also reach a point of this is not working, or I can step out. It's like almost this Wall-E type movie where all these people get really fat in their chairs, and then somehow the chair falls over and they take their goggles off and they're like, wow, this is actually what is around us. And then from there they go back. So I don't see it as the end of the world. I noticed that algorithm is hurtful or can be hurtful, especially for longer term. But I also believe maybe there my question is, humanity isn't so bad at all, but we just need to think, right? Question mark.
Thanks for bringing it up to us. I'll let the professor answer first.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's a good point. And I mean, I was I played role playing games when I was young, and back then in the 80s, 90s, that was supposed to be the end of the world, the end of the youth, health of the youth, mental health of the youth. Anyway, it's very, it'll be a sect and kill each other. Sooner or later. So yeah,
you'll become Satanist.
Exactly. Yeah,
like animal sacrifice, human fear, sacrifices, right?
Yeah, skepticism of new technology and new culture has always been there, of course. I guess, and it's hard to say how bad it is and how bad it's going to be. But I think two things, I guess, maybe make it stand out. I think so. One is this: how stimulating it can be to get all this input. It's not the screen itself. I mean, it could be a hologram or some kind of, you know, music that, or something that's just so intense and so catching your attention so effectively. So that's what I think about. So why is computer games a problem? It's great, computer games. I mean, it's interesting and it's fun and it's educational, but it's just because it grabs your attention so much that it outcompetes nature or things that are slower, because our brains are made and they're not used to that kind of exposure. Mm-hmm. And I think that is new, and it's accelerating. It's not new in kind, but it's more and more intense. I think that makes us, should make us more careful. The other thing is what we talked about, that our environment is so much shaped by these powers or forces or companies that we don't know really and we can't control. And that would be the problem even if it was a physical environment. If my physical, I woke up in my bed, and then, you know, my bedroom was designed by Google or by McDonald's or Coca-Cola or some, you know, whoever.
And they could change it every day.
By you guys, with your own agenda for how my life would run. And I go out in the kitchen and then, you know, something else happened and the music comes on and, you know, it's all sort of low tech, but it's all designed by someone else, like with a purpose. Mm-hmm. Then that would be a problem. And this is what we have more and more online, not only, but to a large extent. And again, that's not about the screen so much, but about what control do I have and do we have together over the environment in which we live our lives.
Yeah, I read a study that was really shocking for me. I read a couple of years ago. So babies that use a pacifier have something like a 20% higher chance of developing addiction than babies who don't use pacifiers. That was like, wow, really? How is this not well-known information? I don't know if it's very well-controlled studies, but what I understood from this is that, like, you know, when you're a little baby, then your neural pathways, the foundation of your neural pathways are getting set. And so I think you're right, Floris, like we don't know for sure, like it's not the end of the world and we don't know what the effect is going to be. And probably it's not all just doom and gloom. Like maybe, you know, human society seems to be doing better in many ways than what's happened before. But I do think we are embarking in a massive experiment at the moment, and we don't know what the consequences of it is going to be. And we're doing it very uncritically. So I think, you know, just like, you know, at least me and my wife, we really don't know what to do with our, you know, we have a almost 2-year-old now as well. Like right now he's basically never touched an iPad or a phone or anything with a screen. We don't have a television in our house, so we've just completely kept him off. But we know we can't continue to do that for a very long time. The time's coming soon. And so how do we do that? And I think that there's a kind of fear and trepidation, which some people seem to be lacking a little bit when it comes to just like, it's always easier to just give your kid a phone and then like, okay, now he's looked after for the next couple of hours. And I just see that kind of like hyper attitude that sometimes comes out from kids that have been on YouTube or whatever it is too much. So it's a meditation. That's what it is. It's a meditation of your attention on a specific object and allowing it to be guided by a commercial company that has an agenda. That's what Kala was saying. It's not changing everything, but it's not without impact either. It's not totally without influence.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Are you happy with that, Floris? Or do you want to comment?
No, I'm happy. I completely understand. And obviously, there are many influences as well. And with the pacifier thing, I immediately was thinking about what would the controlled group then be. But interesting, so to say. Mm-hmm. I do recognize especially the addiction, at least with the physical group, in which I sit right now, where just the feeling of, hey, I don't know where I read this, but you should really try to focus, like when you're sitting on the couch, how far your mobile phone actually is. And most of the times it's within hand reach. Mm-hmm. And that for me was actually like, holy shit, there is really something going on. So what you're saying, Kale, yeah, I get it. Yeah.
The control. Getting your phone on the train and being like 3 days without it, it's like, it's a part of you that's missing now, right? They've become a part of us. We are joined with them. They have been implanted in us. So yeah, it's certainly addiction, I think, is the right word. And like, not, you know, we have to live with addictions. None of us are completely free from them, I guess. Okay. Snav, do you want to take this one on the podcast? Are you up for that? Yeah, let's hear from you then. Yeah,
thanks. I really like what Kelly was saying about like when you're finding purpose or mission, then you start with connection first. Or when you make the meetings, you start with connection and safety. And there's also something, Gabor Mate, he's like a trauma psychotherapist, and he also says that the opposite of addiction is connection. And that's really like connecting to this mediated information that we are getting. I wonder if you are familiar with the solar punk, which is like a fiction movement of sorts. And this is something when I saw this first, it was it's basically like against cyberpunk, which cyberpunk is like everything robots take over. What Flores was talking about, Wall-E situation. This is kind of a thing, and solar punk. I think this is one solution to actually produce entertainment that is. Hopeful, that is almost utopistic instead of dystopian and machines take over. So actually that's what I wanted to ask, if you know about the entertainment that is actually creating a vision for us, the inspiration for us for let's say better future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Steph.
Yeah, good question. No, I'm learning from you here. Solar punk. That's great.
Check it out there.
I just have to agree with the sentiment of your question. This is quite important. I mean, to find this. I said I started a Man in Mission with Peter Ellenberg at Mundekula Retreat Center. And when he started that retreat center for a long time, they had a little leaflet called Happy News, I think it was called, just to sort of counter the negativity of just news, you know. That you get from TV or newspapers or whatever, and you just have, you know, sort of small positive things from the local area mostly, and just to get that out there to sort of counterforce, just to focus on positive things. I mean, positive thinking doesn't always work, but to give attention to what is positive and creative and inspires you is of course great. So yeah, I guess I try to sometimes look for those movies, but just in sort of mainstream context. I'm not aware of like a particular other complementary movement like what you're talking about.
But I really like the way, Kelly, that you frame it in like what we give attention to. And in some way, like our problems, I guess, and tell me, Slav, if you agree with this, it's like we have an excess of attention. Before, we had to use all of our attention just to survive in some way, right? Like, or in our local community, like creating food and stuff like that. And now, you know, we've mechanicized, or, you know, we're such efficient society. So most people don't actually have anything to do. And so that's why, like, you know, we have the what's now called the time passing industry, which is all of the online stuff, right? It's just about passing time with our attention. It's like the most valuable resources in the world is our attention, but we don't actually know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like we are outsourcing, like, which is useful to some extent, but we're outsourcing so many things that we outsource care for children or our time, our attention for the children, which then becomes pacifier and all these things. It's basically, we're just using pacifiers to pass time. So that's also my thinking, like we need to create fiction that is not about death of humanity by machines and such a cool visuals, but actually, hey, can we actually create a fiction that creates the world? Which we create the world with the mission that we are talking about. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's both sad and inspiring that the movie Avatar, you know, right? You mean Avatar? I hope most have seen it. It's a good movie. Otherwise, go see it or find it somewhere. But it's both creates this wonderful then sci-fi, you know, nature and another planet, and helps us, help me sort of connect with nature here on Earth via a movie done on computers about nature on another planet. Sort of helps me connect to the apple trees outside my door and appreciate them more. It's sort of a bit roundabout, but it works. So it's great. And then, of course, the movie later on becomes more of a war movie. But the interesting part is, I think, the first part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so important, I think, that I love the point, Slav, about, like, you know, anyway, it comes to community as well. Orientating ourselves towards communities which have a positive focus. So, yeah, apologies if I talk a little bit about the end of the world or to cyber technical dystopias or something like that. Actually, I'm a bit of an optimist, but there's some things that I think are challenging. So, and children, putting our attention on the next generation as well, and not seeing that as like, oh, the state is going to look after them. I think that's also a vital thing as well. Like, it was a good. Okay, I think before I go on a rant about state childcare, we'll end the podcast here and then open up the floor for everybody else. But thanks for the conversation here.
You've been listening to Conversations on Masculinity with Manifesto. We enjoy good discussions, but far more importantly, we are a real community with plenty of opportunities for you to engage online and in person. So check out our website on manifesto.com to learn more. And if you enjoyed the content here, then please share this podcast with a friend. Thanks.